Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a wonderful Christmas, everyone. We realize that we do not have the best phone connection here with our guest, Ken Johnson. Hope you will bear with us, though. Things are about to get interesting. We're going to go down the list of very specific photos and images that came from the moon, what Ken Johnson thinks they really represent, that and a lot more coming up in this next segment of Coast to Coast AM. Ken Johnson, let's talk about some of the images that you preserved. A couple of them we've posted on the Coast website so that our listeners can reference them. One shows what appears to be three big wheels made out of stone or something that looks like stone with what appears to be an axle through the middle of them. Do you remember that image, and what can you tell us about it?
I understand that image actually was taken by a Russian craft on the lunar surface, and what it looks to me like is an auger. You know, I've used a lot of those here on the farm to bore holes in, and it certainly does not look like any type of a natural geological rock of some sort. So that one stands out very strongly as not being a natural item. So, no, I would look at that and say, wow, how in the world did that get on the lunar surface?
There's another image that we posted, what you've labeled as a blue ship. It just looks like a blue blob. What is that? How do you interpret that one?
I think somebody else said it was a blue ship. I've never said that. That was a picture. If you'll notice, you've got Ed Mitchell standing in the area out there, and Gene Cernan's taking the picture. Now, as I mentioned earlier, on the lunar surface, when they bring down the gold mylar and lens to protect their eyes from the glare, they would not even be able to see that. And when you take the kind of the pictures that we have, and that actually was an Apollo 14 shot number AS14669301, and if you turn the gain down and adjust your filter, not your filter, but your focusing, that brings up all kinds of structures in that same area where you're looking at the prism, the light effect. So you've got the sun reflecting off something that's being suspended above the lunar surface. There's another one a little bit further over to the right. Just you look up from where the astronaut's standing up to probably about the 1 o'clock position, up about an inch above that, if you're looking at the picture I'm looking at. And when you turn the gain up and you take a good look at it, then you're going to see other lines and buttresses and support. So there is something in the background that the astronauts were unable to see while they're on the surface. And again, the scientists that have looked at this stuff said silicone or glass. In fact, I know that glass is considered a very strong, in a vacuum, it has the tensile strength of steel. It will fracture. But if you were going to build anything because of the abundance of silicone on the lunar surface, you would certainly want to use glass as a means to produce your domes and produce your beams and supports. And there's some really fantastic pictures. There's one picture with Apollo 15 along Mount Hadley. There is what looks to me probably about a quarter of a mile long beam laying up the side of a mountaintop, and it's curved as it's leaning and sagged. So there's some really phenomenal pictures that show some strange things on the moon.
Well, talk to me about them. Let's go down a laundry list. Which ones jump out at you that you saw either while you were still at NASA or later as you analyzed these photos?
Well, you've got an excellent one up right now, of course, and then the picture on the backside of the moon, which it was really difficult for me to try to remember the name of the crater some 20, 30 years later. And Steve Troy and some other people were kind of doing they were challenging me and making me try to recall things. It was hypnosis, but we kept going over and over. And then we got out some of the charts showing where the command module was circling moon on the backside. And then as it came up on the crater, a rather large crater on the backside called Tsiolkovsky, it rang a bell, and there it was. That was the one where we had seen the domes and things on the inside. So for years, I actually didn't have time to be involved because I went on to work for the Boeing company as a 737 flight instructor, and busy, married, and raising a family, so I wasn't active in that. I did wind up, there was a little group of us, we started getting involved in UFOs and tracking what was going on. We formed our own little group in Boeing we called the Majestic 12, because somebody would read something and they'd make a copy and they'd send it through the Boeing mail to us, and we kept track with it that way. And I got a hold of a book, the very first one, which was The Monuments of Mars, and Joe Rosario, one of the engineers, says, oh, by the way, Mr. Hoagland's going to be giving a conference at the Science Center here in Seattle. And I'm one of these kind of people, if I get the opportunity to get the author of a book to sign one of the books, I'll go to any length to try to get there. So I typed up a nice little letter of introduction because I'd heard him on Coast to Coast talk about if there was anybody out there that had data or information or pictures, please come forward. And here I'm sitting there with all these pictures, and I typed up who I was, what I'd done, and I went down, and they had some people sitting out front taking tickets. I gave them the letter. The young lady read the letter. She says, don't move. Stay right where you're at. And I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble. And a couple minutes later, Mr. Hoagland came out. He says, you're who we've been looking for. And that's kind of how I met Mr. Hoagland for the first time. The next day, he brought his whole crew over to my my house, and we started looking at pictures I had. And again, mine are first-generation prints off the negative. And you're going to see the detail and stuff in these prints, which I've kept inside document protectors and inside a safe and stuff for years and decades now to protect them. So every once in a while, something will come up, and then Mr. Hoagland will get in touch with me and say, can you pull up this particular picture and take a look at it and see if something is really there? Because like you say, there are people that, I don't know, some people look like they think that an alligator is crawling across the surface on the moon. Well, they've got no evidence or documents to prove that. But when you're looking at anomalies like this, this prism effect on this picture, and a lot of the terraced arcologies and domes and things, and if you look at them in the actual prints that we had in mind, they stand out very distinctly. And my hat is off to the people who have been using these poor quality prints that have been sent out. Now, by the way, you know, all in the catalogs that NASA puts out of their pictures, not all the pictures are listed there. Now, that ought to send up a red flag, too. And I can say that from some of the scientists have said, well, they have decided, well, there's a picture. They wonder what the next one would look like, and they'll just add a number to it and request it. And lo and behold, they'll wind up getting a picture that's not inside the catalog. And it usually has some anomaly in it that we can only surmise that someone didn't want us to see.
Go down the list. What other impressive photos that stand out in your mind? I mean, you've got a couple of things that are ascribed as being superstructures or like buildings.
Right. Well, the main ones that are, you'll see arches. You can see in some of the pictures, you can see where it looks like they're actual, I'd call it a road, if you want to call it that, up to where there are arches or domes. There are pictures that show a perfectly round hole, which you might ascribe that to a vent, not a crater, because if it were a crater, you know, you'd see the ridges and any central peaks if they were a large one or small. And so there are a lot of places where you'd be looking at the surface, and then right over there you'll see a vent or some kind of a hole. And it's not a defect in the picture. And then there's so much left. It's kind of hard to tell. Another one was during Apollo 15, astronaut Jim Irwin, and making my brain here dig here. Dave Scott, Al Wharton, and Jim Irwin, when they were on the lunar surface and they went over to Hadley Reel, and some of the pictures they took across there, there are some photographs from the command module looking down, which actually shows beams stretching across from one side of the reel, or call it a crack or a ditch, whatever you call it, but it's called Hadley Reel. And it's exposing some of the substructure under the moon. And I've had numerous people tell me, well, on Apollo 11 and 12 and 14, and actually on all the missions, whenever they would finish and rendezvous with the command module, they would remotely back the lunar module away from the command module, fire its rockets, and set it into a descent to crash into the lunar surface. Whenever it would hit the lunar surface, the scientific experiments that we had on the surface, which were checking for earthquakes or seismic information, the moon would ring like a bell, and not just for a few seconds, but for over a day, it'd keep vibrating and ringing, which made some people say that it could the moon possibly be hollow inside. Well, that's another good reason we need to go back. People used to joke at it since I was a lunar module test man. I said, if we could get the keys to the craft, would you fly us back and let us check and see what's really on the moon or if we can find a way to get inside?
Do you believe, and I know it's speculation on your part, that we didn't go back because of what was seen up there, what things were found?
Well, I was still at NASA when we were finishing up the Apollo missions, and then I actually went to work on over into the space shuttle program for a while. But there was a lot of scuttlebutt going on about during the Apollo 17 about the transmission. Well, no, actually, go back to Apollo 11, that whenever Neil and Buzz were on the surface, we maintained a separate communications link for the medical advisor for each mission, so that all of the communications you're hearing live over the radio and on television when they're talking, when they switch over to the secure line, you're not going to hear what they're saying. And some of the guys that were at Mission Control said that there was a conversation of saying, you know, they're here, they're on the rim of the crater, they're watching us. I've had that thrown up to me several times, and well, I was there, and there were some of the other NASA people like myself that were there that actually claimed that they had heard this. And then the other one was that you know, don't return. So this kind of really gets into some fascinating things about who are we on this planet? How did we get here? Are we a hybrid? Are the ones that manipulated our DNA, are they the ones that were telling us don't go back to the moon and we're not ready yet? It can get into a whole lengthy discussion on exactly why we did not go back to the moon. And now we're talking about, well, let's go, but I don't see anything really happening that would say we are. Now, China is really going, moving headlong and trying to get back to the moon. They've got quite a program going. And then also what Buzz Aldrin talked about, that where the real information is on Phobos, the moon around Mars. So
Where he talked
still
about an
not.
obelisk or something like that.
Well, we have a lot of obelisks that we found on the lunar surface in some of the pictures. That's some of the other anomalies that you can see. And these things stick up almost, some of them a mile high. And of course, with no atmosphere, there's no problem with that and a little low gravity. But now, the obelisk on Phobos, a perfect tetrahedral shape. It kind of, and its orbit. And then when the European space agencies were transmitting back telemetry data through or past Phobos, they were able to basically create a ground-penetrating radar image of what they think the inside of Phobos is, and it showed chambers, rooms, and things. So some of the best minds around it are saying, well, that could well be an abandoned spacecraft of some size that's been left there. So space treaty was set up so that no nation could go and claim another celestial body as their eminent domain. Yet, if that is not a planetoid or an asteroid or what have you, if it's actually a spacecraft, whoever can get there first is the one that's going to be able to claim and get all the data and information and reverse engineering or find out what's going on. So you can see a big rush going on in the Chinese, the Japanese, European Space Agency. Yet, we haven't seemed to pick up the gauntlet yet and start pushing. We watch the space shuttle expire.
This is speculation on your part, of course, but I'm asking you your opinion about these objects that were seen, the wheels and structures and things of that sort. Your suspicion is that they're not necessarily ancient, that they were current, that there was somebody up there with them, that they're not just something that was left behind long, long ago,
No,
or
I think
both.
the photographs, and another one that was mentioned was one on Apollo 17, which it looks like a robotic head down in the crater. Those things are ancient, okay? And yet, when you can see the domes and things like in Tsiolkovsky that I'm talking about, that would be something more modern, okay? So most of the things that you're looking at are in the area of what I would call ancient domes, ancient ruins. Yet some of the towers could certainly be of more current construction and use. So you've got both elements there, ancient as well as modern times.
In reading about this, I've heard it suggested that there is, although, as you said, there's stuff all over the place up there, that maybe the backside of the moon, or what some people call the dark side of the moon, that there are larger projects, mining operations, things that look like mining operations. Am I exaggerating that?
I've only seen a few of the pictures, and one particular one on the backside that I saw that actually looks like an ocean liner. It actually really does look like one of the Star Wars spaceships that they had in the movie that And you know, the old days we used to say, don't believe anything you hear and only half of what you see. Nowadays, you almost can't believe anything you see because of Photoshop and the technique that some people can do. Fortunately, we didn't have that technology back when we were bringing the pictures back, the negatives back from the Apollo lunar mission. So we have real solid data rather than digital stuff that can be manipulated.
What I'm wondering is, you made sort of a reference to this about others within NASA, that you talked to them about this stuff. Was there sort of like a UFO brotherhood as you're looking at these images while you're still working there? Do you speak openly to colleagues, coworkers, and say, hey, and compare notes? And what do you think that is?
No, back in those days, if you talked about UFOs, you were kind of, you know, one step away from the extra long funny suit. No, we kept those kind of things to ourselves. If it was something having to do with the mission and it was kind of strange, then you know, that would happen. An example, the U.S. Geological Survey set up four portable buildings outside the Lunar Receiving Laboratory. And to even get into those, you had to have a top secret clearance. And one of my associates, a friend, I'll come up with his name here in a minute. His job was to help them create three-dimensional relief of potential landing zone. And now, if this was supposed to be a public race to the moon, and it was public, and all the information was coming out to the public free, et cetera, why was it requiring a top secret to go in and while they were selecting the specific sites they were going to land on? And were they afraid somebody was going to get there first and shoot them down? I don't know. But it was strange why that would be done. The guy I'm speaking of, his name was Rocky Eaton, E-A-T-O-N, and he would take the samples we brought back and actually make a aluminum foil cast of them, and then make artificial stones, rocks, that looked like the originals, so they people could have them on their paperweights or what have you. The government officials and the NASA officials that get plaques and things with a sample of a certain moon rock. He was the one that would bring me in and out of the JEDEC survey group where they were actually planning each mission. And for us to have actually landed at each one of these spots, and I'm sure you've probably heard it before, but I've talked to the actual guy who developed, with TRW, developed the telemetry, trajectory, everything to specifically land at a certain spot at a certain time. And he since then went back. He's now passed away, but he said to have landed there with Constellation Orion at a certain location and all these things at that specific moment, you would have had to have fixed that as the primary reason for going there, and then worked always back to a specific launch time, angle, and orbit, and translunar insertion. Everything would have to be built up, folks, to do that, and why they would go to that extreme to be able to show that we could land at a certain place at a certain time. Who are we trying to show that we're all grown up, that we're actually into the space program? We need to be recognized as spacefaring species.
All right. You said that, you know, the colleagues that you had, that you couldn't really openly talk about this stuff then. What about since? Have you been in communication with guys you worked with before and now speak at least confidentially about what was on the photos and what it represents?
I actually have not spoken with any of the guys that I worked with back in those days. And I put out the request that any of them, if they do have any information and data, for them to come forward. And we need to, I mean, let's face it, I was the youngest kid on the block, just about, of all the consultant pilots, young engineers there, and I'm turning 70, and so many of them are gone now. And if they have been keeping these secrets all this time, they need to come forward, because what can they do to us now at our age, you know? They can say, well, let nature take its course. But I really challenge any of the guys that we worked with and that were at the Lunar Receiving Laboratory, the photo lab, that were privy to any of the unusual things that I've talked about, some of them. They really do need to get in contact with either yourself, or they can contact me, and we'll try to get the right information out to the people
I would imagine that talking to you would be poison, that it would be bad news for anybody if NASA found out that somebody else was talking to you, certainly for any current employees of NASA. We're going to take a break and come back with more of our conversation with Ken Johnson about anomalies seen on the moon and maybe expand the conversation to include Martian anomalies as well. Stay with us, everyone. We're talking with Ken Johnson, formerly of NASA, talking about anomalous objects seen in photos taken on the surface of the moon. We want to expand that a little bit to take a conversation about things that were seen on Mars as well. And then I'd like to ask him his opinion about whether or not we have a secret space program. Also, what happens when you become a whistleblower and talking about this stuff out in the open? Are there personal ramifications and consequences? That and more coming up after the break on Coast to Coast AM. Ken Johnson, talk to me about the circumstances surrounding you leaving NASA or your employment there in that photo lab. I read online Jim Oberg, who we referenced earlier in the program, saying that you had made these crackpot allegations, but you weren't fired. Nobody even asked you to resign. Tell me about how that went down.
Well, of course, I wasn't with NASA at the time, and leaving NASA was all just a matter of the normal process of which all of us engineers that were there, once we'd finish one project, would wind up getting laid off. We'd have to go to another company and get with that next part of the next project. That's, you know, I wound up with the shuttle program for a while, and then got laid off on that. I went to Denver to work for Martin Marietta for a short period and got picked up with the approach and landing team on the first space shuttle we had, and then out to Vandenberg Air Force Base. So it's not directly tied in very close to when, let's see, he and I were good friends, but later on, anyone who's going to come out and come out of the closet, if you want to call it that, and start telling exactly what took place and what it seemed to tell the truth, you're going to have to expect that they're going to be the hatchet jobs. They're going to come out and try to discredit you, and as you've seen done with numerous people in like Area 15, 51, I've forgotten the guy there, but they erased him out of the books. And fortunately, I kept the books and could prove that, oh, yes, I was there. So I would advise anyone that does, you need to come out because that's how you're going to stay protected. You know, thanks to being on with Art Bell and George Norrie and yourself, a little anecdote here. One of my co-pilots, it was Boeing that went over to China. He was teaching a class to the Chinese, 100% translated. During a break, he was talking to the translator, and they got to talking about the moon and things. And he says, oh, yeah, my friend Ken Johnston was that. And the Chinese guy said, oh, also, you know Ken Johnston. So, in other words, 20 million people plus know the name. And so, hopefully, if anything were to happen to me, something would be brought up. So, you are going to have to be sure you're pretty much squeaky clean the best you can be in your life, because they, just like politics, they're going to go dig into your background, do everything they can to try to discredit you.
I saw some stuff about your doctorate. Do you have a doctorate, and if so, what's it in?
Okay, now to give you an idea of why I wound up going that route, when they were trying to select a new group of astronauts, the ones that there was 26 new ones they were going to select. I was up for the program. And I'd made it through all of the interviews and all of the physicals and all the testing because I'd been doing, you know, the same work as the astronauts all along. Astronaut Vance Brandt was in charge of the selection committee. And since my office was one floor below them in building number 3, as I recall, is the astronaut building. Anyway, he called me up to his office. He says, Ken, he says, it's gotten political now. He says, we know you can do the job because you've been doing it with us. He says, but it's political. The government wants us to hire PhD scientists. And you only have 3 BS degrees, and they don't want jet jocks. We're going to hire people that we know we can train to fly. And so your name's been cut from the list. And that was really hard to take because you kind of lay out all your wares, and you've been doing something, and someone say, you know, you came up short. So along with that and the history in our family, my first cousin, now it's kind of interesting how my brother, myself, and our first cousin all wound up at NASA at the same time doing unique things to help us get to the moon. And back when he was Captain Donald Garrett, my first cousin, he had done the vacuum chamber testing in the command module, where I'd been working at the stuff with the lunar module. Anyway, when the Apollo 1 fire happened, he left the space program and became a Baptist minister and later a physics professor for the University of Arizona, and he's still up in Flagstaff. Well, and my background is pretty strong family religion, and here I was being turned down to the astronaut program, and I'm questioning myself and what my goal in life or what my purpose in life was. So I went, when I was with Martin Marietta in Denver, I connected up with the Reformed Baptist Seminary and got ordained, and then completed a doctorate degree in Divinity, and in so doing that, with all my science background, it was very easy to go in and do a doctorate in metaphysics, and so I completed both of those, one in 81, and the other one was in 82. Excuse me just a moment here.
So you get a doctorate in this, but it comes back to bite you. I mean, because somebody like Oberg can say, oh, this guy's got a crackpot degree in metaphysics. He's not a scientist.
Yep, that's what happens. But, you know, I earned my degrees for the requirements and things of the school at the time. And, I have no complaints. And I'll hold mine up against anybody else that wants to challenge it.
Back to this. All right. Back to the point about your departure, though, were you fired? Did somebody fire you because you talked about this stuff?
Okay. As I said, when there was that the book Hoagland and Barra put out called Dark Mission, and they had quoted verbatim a lot of the same stories that I've relayed tonight, and Oberg contacted Ms. Kay Ferrari of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, who was in charge of the Solar System Ambassador Program. She contacted me, and she said, well, she didn't kind of tell me. I found out later that it was Oberg that had triggered it. In fact, that I do think I asked her, and she did say that Mr. Oberg had questioned my credentials and that I had said things about my employer, us being Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And she said, so we think it'd be better for everyone if you were to just resign. You know, they kind of wanted me just to walk away and not create a fuss. Well, I wasn't going to do that. And I stood up with them and I said, no, want to get rid of me, you have to fire me. And so they summarily dismissed me. And that was the end of me being a solar system ambassador for NASA and JPL.
Do you have a letter that says you're fired?
I have letters. Yes, I do. I have letters from her. And they have one that says that I was my services were no longer needed.
Are there repercussions for you being associated, for example, with John Lear or for Richard Hoagland? Does that open you up to allegations of crackpottery?
No, I don't think so, because in my case, you know, I was the guy that was there, and it's firsthand. It's not where, you know, in Mr. Hoagland's place, where he's done the research and he's talked to those of us that were there, and so in essence, he's publishing it secondhand. Although from us, it's firsthand, so it's kind of hard to refute someone when we've got the evidence and the information right there, and you're talking to the people that were the ones that were there that did it. So I don't think it has hurt me in any way. But right now, back in the NASA days there in Houston, I got involved with the Civil Air Patrol, which those of you who know is part of the auxiliary of the Air Force. We do 95% of all the search and rescue that goes on in the United States, and had the cadet program. Well, I've gotten back involved in that once I got my grandson up through Eagle. He wanted to learn to fly, and I said, well, why don't we join the Civil Air Patrol again? And, so they're very well aware of who I am and that whatever I've had to do with NASA and the things. So long as you stick with the truth and you tell the truth, you know, the truth shall set you free, and I live by that creed.
Anybody ever come to you and say, shut the heck up, just keep your mouth shut or else, or any attempt to break in and find the photos and steal them?
No, that was one of the things I made clear, is that I keep them in a locked vault, you know, safety deposit, so that there's no reason to try to track me down and try to find, you know, those. And plus, since then, they've all been digitized and put in. I've been requested to put together. Now, mind you, this is a civilian program. We paid for the pictures. They're not copyrighted, and we can do anything with them that we want to do. So I've considered putting together DVDs of each mission and the pictures and things that go along with those. And so these would be digital copies off of the very first generation of the negatives, and they're very high quality. So that I may do that in my senior years, you know, if I have time to.
Again, the question about repercussions, threats. Anybody tell you to shut up or else?
No, I haven't had that happen. It's actually been the other way around. It's always been people thanking me for having the guts to stand up. I was at a conference down in Florida, and a gentleman came up to me afterwards that was wearing what I recognized very quickly, which is a 33rd degree sonic symbol on a chain around his neck. And he came up and introduced himself, and I gave him the proper handshake, being third second degree myself. And he said, "We're keeping our eye on you." And that's been about the most strange thing that's happened to me. But since then, no one has, to my knowledge, has ever come back to approach me again. But because there's a lot of Masonic stuff that went on through the space program.
So, well, that could be a whole other topic for a show. Let me ask you this. There was a mission, something called Clementine, and I'm just speaking off the top of my head, but it seemed to me it was a thorough mapping and photographing of the lunar surface. It always struck me as an odd kind of a mission, and I was wondering if you had access to those photos or where they might be or what those images might show.
No, those all that all happened after I left the space. I left NASA in Houston in 1980, so Clementine and those came along much later on. But I have seen images and things that were sent back, and I'm going off the top of my head too here. If Clementine was one that did they crash it into the lunar surface down near the South Pole? Does that ring a bell with you?
There was a mission like that, but I thought Clementine was just it circled the moon taking photographs, but I could be mistaken.
Real interesting, back in the days that we were going there, I had a National Geographic wall map of the moon, and the backside, three-quarters of the backside was just blank because we didn't know what it looked like. We didn't have any. Of course, now you can get a globe, if you want to, of the moon and all the craters and everything on the backside. We've done a thorough job of mapping. And actually, we know more, I think, about the moon than we do about the Earth.
Let's talk about Mars for a second. You know, we all remember seeing the face on Mars, and that is largely discredited, at least in the public's view. It's just an anomaly of shadow and light. And then Hoagland and others have written about the Cydonia structures. What's your take on all of that?
Well, and I've been very much involved with them through that. And the media or our adversaries, what do you want to call them, have done an extremely good job in doctoring photos and getting images from Mars of such an angle and such that and warping the angle in which the pictures were taken in order to make them look like it was like they dubbed the one the sandbox. Instead of looking like the face on Mars, it looked like, you know, a cat scratching mess on the surface. So there are some fantastic photographs that have come back from Mars, and particularly one I like is the one around the South Pole area that shows the vegetation growing. And it was Arthur C. Clarke that came out. He says, "We now have proof that there is life on Mars." This was before he passed away, of course. And another one that I like very much is one that shows the crack along the surface on Mars and shows a tubular tunnel device, either a underground transport system. There are fantastic pictures of ancient ruins. And again, if you tie those back into the ancient Sumerian texts and stuff, they had bases on the moon, the Agigi did, and we're looking at several hundred thousand or 150,000 years old archaeology structures that have been weathered away, because there's a lot of weather takes place on Mars. And we fought for decades to prove that Mars had water. And you know, NASA's not going to admit anything until you have so much data, so much documentation, absolutely proven they can't refute it. Then they go, "Oh wow, we just discovered water." So, you know, or go ahead.
Well, why is that? I mean, you look at all the evidence concerning Mars, for example. It seemed like one of those early Viking missions, found what looked like evidence of life on Mars, and they quickly discredited that. And then every mission since has refrained from even running the tests. I guess we're running there's something on the way to Mars now that will check for life in the soil and things of that sort. You would think that would be a pretty fundamental question you'd want an answer to right off the bat.
Well, you would hope so, but again, you have to go back to what the guidelines were for when we were going to the moon, and back before we were just getting started with the Mercury program. Brookings Institute issued a report. It was actually published in the New York Times, which discussed what would we do if we were to discover evidence of alien civilizations, either on the Earth, the Moon, the Mars, within our close part of our solar system. And the direction from Brookings was it would have such a shocking effect on our society. And they quoted, you know, what happened when we first came in contact with the natives in the Philippines that had never seen modern man, and they developed the cargo cult and stuff because of airplanes flying over during World War II. And they said, in time, a lesser society comes in contact with a greater society, the lesser one ceases to exist and loses its identity. And that Brookings said that if we did discover anything like that, it should not be made public, because the scientists doing the work think that they're out on the cutting edge and they know everything there is. If we think that, so take a look at our atomic charts. In the past 50 years, how many new elements have we added to that atomic chart? So science does not know everything. And the rule that we were going by is that if they discover something, don't publish it. I think we're close to a point of disclosure. I went to and met with Dr. Richard Greer and his group on disclosure.
Stephen Greer?
Stephen Greer. Right, excuse me. And I hope that we really are at a point where we can disclose the truth. You've got the Vatican coming out now saying that, yes, there's more likely there is life out there. It's kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, the roosters or the owls or whoever, whatever religion they want to call them, I don't care. But you've got those that are in the know and those that want to know. And I think I'm kind of swinging on both sides of that fence. I know some of the stuff, but I'd really like to know the rest of the truth. And on Mars, we've got so much evidence of life. The very first one, when they found that canard, and what they do, they use the little claw and grinder, and they ground it right off so that it wasn't there anymore. And now we found the sedimentary rocks from water erosion, and it's just the evidence is all over everywhere that at one time Mars was capable of supporting microbial life. So we're right on the threshold of discovering a lot more.
Well, of course, we'd all like to know the ultimate truth. Do you have a theory on who the ultimate keeper of the secrets is? I mean, is it NASA? Is it someone above NASA? The information that NASA has, does it go somewhere else and somebody keeps it in a vault somewhere?
Well, I guess it's my own personal take on that. And is it, if you could get into the vaults at the Vatican, you could find out an awful lot of information. And the organizations, having a degree in divinity, having studied all the religions, it's amazing how it changes your point of view with regards to deity. And there are the occult organizations. I don't want to call them, well, occult actually was a good term. Masonic groups, it's been usurped and taken over. There's a conflict between the American Masonic Order and the European British. What influenced the whole space program, if you go back, you've got the Wernher von Braun, who I had the privilege of meeting once before he passed away. The paperclip guys, I worked directly with a guy by name Billy Greider, American engineer that worked with all the paperclip guys when they were testing the V-2 rockets down in White Sands. I have no clue why I have been blessed or cursed with being able to be in the right place at the right time with the right stuff to be privy to so much of this that has taken place. And so I believe that there are the watchers, those that have been stayed on this planet all this time, that have kept pace, track of what we're doing and how we are maturing as a species. I really believe that's true. And I've come to believe that ET does exist, even from my own childhood experiences and little astral travel and biological out-of-body experiences. So, you know, I get into and I research these things, and I try to study them, learn as much as I can to where I can understand a little more of the truth. And my prayer has always been, in order just let me know the truth. So that's what I'm seeking and trying to do.
We're going to take a break, then open up the phone lines. My guest is Ken Johnson, talking about his experiences and knowledge within NASA, photographs of anomalies on the moon and Mars. Your questions for Ken Johnson after this on Coast to Coast AM.